Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present Kathy Hurwit, Chief of Staff for Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, Democrat of Illinois, and Dr. Manning Marable, Professor of History and Political Science at Columbia University, who debate the merits of Ralph Nader's Green Party candidacy. And John Nichols, an editor at the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and a columnist with The Nation magazine, who assesses the Nader candidacy's influence on progressive politics in the years ahead. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With resistance in Western Europe growing to genetically modified food, biotech companies are looking east for new markets. In the poorer nations of Eastern Europe, there is less government regulation of the food supply and fewer activists out in the streets denouncing Frankenfoods. The US government is preparing to spend millions of dollars in foreign aid to promote biotech foods in Eastern Europe. Already, biotech giants like Monsanto and Novartis are lobbying governments to gain easy access to consumers. According to the news magazine In These Times, the biotech industry is funding an aggressive public relations blitz in the Czech Republic, boasting of the benefits of genetically engineered food. Industry groups have also distributed a documentary, The Fight Over Genes, on Czech television, that depicts environmental critics as irresponsible Luddites. But eco-activists are now making a stand against the biotech invasion. Tamara Malkova of the Ukrainian-based group Green Dossier stated, "In the past decade, we have become a dumping ground for the nuclear industry. Now we face bioengineering, another hazardous technology unwanted in the West." London-based activist Iza Krzyzewska laments, "It is as if it is the Wild West in the form of these biotech companies meeting the Wild East. It's the worst of both worlds. It's exploiting a lack of public awareness and fragile democracies." The US Supreme Court is considering a test case on reproductive rights. In Ferguson versus City of Charleston, South Carolina, the court will decide if mandatory drug tests for pregnant women, where all positive tests are handed over to the local police, violate the Due Process Clause of the US Constitution. Few people would advocate that pregnant women consume addictive drugs, but mandatory tests raise an important constitutional question. Should women be forced to give away their rights to equal protection and forced to undergo unreasonable searches and seizures simply because they are pregnant? In 1989, the Medical University of South Carolina, in the name of fetal protection, began drug tests of all pregnant women. The university hospital, the only one open to indigent women in the state, threatened to arrest women who tested positive for drug use. Some women spent their pregnancies in jail, while others were arrested after they had given birth. Nearly all of the arrested women were black and charged with breaking laws, including drug possession, child neglect, and distributing drugs to a minor. In 1996, the South Carolina Supreme Court upheld the drug testing program, declaring that a viable fetus is a person under the state's Child Protection Code, a ruling that the U.S. Supreme Court let stand. According to The Nation magazine, women would clearly lose important individual rights if the U.S. Supreme Court upholds the South Carolina drug testing program. Aside from jeopardizing their right to doctor-patient confidentiality, opponents say the state's law dissuades poor women from seeking critical prenatal care that many desperately need. Native American tribes have long sought the return of sacred artifacts housed in museum collections. But despite the backing of federal law, tribal elders find themselves faced with another hurdle: the chemicals used by museums to treat those artifacts. An article in Mother Jones magazine described the frustration felt by tribal officials as they've attempted to utilize the 1990 Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. This act requires museums that receive federal funding turn over sacred artifacts, human remains, and items of religious importance. The problem is that museums have always treated these items with various preservatives to resist decay and infestation while on display. The tragic fact is, these preservatives essentially render the items treated as untouchable and useless for tribal ceremonial use. The experience of David Hostler, who has attempted to reclaim items belonging to the Hooper Valley Indian Tribe of California, is fairly typical. When a sacred headdress was returned by the Peabody Museum in Cambridge, Massachusetts, officials of the museum told him, "Be careful, don't touch it with your bare hands." Beyond that, they had little information to offer. It's certainly no secret that museums have always used preservatives. but in the past it was assumed that treated items would remain on display or in storage. Over the years, artifacts have been treated with DDT, arsenic, mercury, and strychnine. This has forced tribes to depend on chemical testing to determine what items might be safe for return to ceremonial use. Unfortunately, testing is a costly process for which the federal government has provided few funds. So, tribes like the Hopi pause in their efforts to recover many items from museums. They look forward to a day when the toxins can be neutralized without the destruction of the relics themselves. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Fraser. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Democrats concerned about the tight race between Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush have for months been on the attack against Green Party candidate Ralph Nader, who they label as a potential spoiler in election 2000. The New York Times, which has endorsed Gore, has published a series of editorials condemning Mr. Nader's candidacy, going so far as to accuse him of willful prankishness and conducting a self-indulgent crusade. In the closing weeks of the campaign, Vice President Al Gore is making the case that a vote for Nader is a vote for George W. Bush. In dozens of rallies in battleground states such as Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, Gore, his political allies and friends in the entertainment industry have tried to win back disaffected Nader voters with the warning that casting a ballot for the Greens could usher in a Bush presidency, endangering a woman's right to choose, and federal policies on the environment, education and social security. In the final lap of this election, Republicans are sensing victory, and many have bent over backwards to lavish praise on Mr. Nader. GOP allies, in fact, have spent over $100,000 in the final week of the campaign to buy TV ads in Washington, Wisconsin, and Oregon, which feature a portion of a Nader speech attacking Gore's environmental record. Their ad, of course, leaves out a section of that same speech which assails George Bush as a big corporation running for president disguised as a person. While some Green Party activists are defiant, stressing that a Gore defeat would provide a shock to the system that some feel is necessary to start the process of cleaning up the corruption of corporate-dominated politics, other Nader supporters are advocating strategic voting, casting a vote for the Greens only in the 40 states where the contest is already over. Once ignored by the corporate media and the major parties, Ralph Nader and his supporters may now be pivotal in deciding who will win or lose the White House November 7th. Between the Lines presents a debate on the merits of Nader's Green Party candidacy. Supporting Ralph Nader is Dr. Manning Marrable, Professor of History and Political Science and a Director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. Kathy Hurwitt, who has endorsed Vice President Gore, is Chief of Staff for Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, Democrat of Illinois. Hurwitt worked with Citizens Action for 12 years, advocating progressive politics on healthcare, energy and the environment.
First of all, I want to say that I admire Ralph Nader greatly. I've worked with him since I came to Washington in 1976 on everything from trying to stop nuclear power to trying to pass single-payer healthcare, protect the civil justice system. And I've also worked with many people who he has brought into the progressive movement and who are now leaders in their own right. So it's not a question of not admiring Ralph Nader. The concern that I have is you've got a three-person race, but it's really actually a two-person race. If, in fact, Ralph Nader had a serious shot at being in the White House, that would be a very different story. But the real question here is George Bush. The concern that many of us have, and many who, as I say, have fought long and hard with Ralph Nader and look forward to doing so in the future, is that we really could end up with George Bush in the White House. We could end up with a Senate controlled by Trent Lott. I hope not, but we can end up with a House controlled by Tom DeLay and Dick Armey. and George Bush in the White House. And that has got to be a very frightening thought to people across this country who care about the issues that I've just mentioned, who care about civil rights and affirmative action, a woman's right to choose, environmental protections. If, in fact, we were talking about waking up on November 8th and having a serious shot of having Ralph Nader in the White House, that might be a different story. But the fact of the matter is that in a handful of states, Ralph Nader could make the difference between having George Bush in the White House or not. And I think that's why so many of us are so concerned.
Dr. Mirabel, you want to talk about why you're supporting Ralph Nader this election?
Well, perhaps we should begin by saying where we agree, as opposed to focusing on the personalities running for president. We agree that the great danger to a more progressive, democratic America is represented by the Republican right. I agree that we have to do everything we can to mobilize to win back the House of Representatives. It doesn't look likely that the Democrats can win back the U.S. Senate. But in every way, I agree with progressive and liberal Democrats that the Republican right wing is aggressively against reproductive rights, affirmative action, that the Republican right pursues a strategy of favoring the corporate elite against the vast majority of working women and men. So we agree with that. The question is, how do you beat the right? And I think what we have found over the last decade is that the Clinton-Gore administration has actually been a kind of unwitting at times the best ally of mass conservatism in the U.S. It was Clinton who implemented the draconian 1996 Welfare Act that for Hispanic and black women pushed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands into poverty. It was Clinton that passed the crime bill that expanded the use of the death penalty mandated by federal law from something like 3 to over 50 crimes. It was the Clinton and Gore administration that clearly expanded, created the context in which millions of working people, working families, are losing ground. So that if anyone, you know, in the Gore campaign blames Nader for the slippage, the difficulty that Gore has in relating to working class constituencies, it's Gore himself. So I think that in 40 states throughout the country that the election is pretty much over. And instead of one national election, we have to keep in mind the Electoral College determines the outcome in the presidential race. In 40 states throughout most of the South and the West and throughout the Northeast, the election's pretty much over. In about 10 states, and that's really what we're debating, Nader could have an impact upon the race. But in most states, in New York, Gore has about a 15 to 18 point lead. It makes absolutely no sense for progressives or liberals to vote for Al Gore because he's not a progressive. He represents, at best, a policy on the center that actually is to the right of what we used to call liberal republicanism.
I would just like to ask you both on this same line of thought, if you, Kathy Hurwitt, and you, Dr. Manning Marble, believe that the Green Party is a mechanism to bring the Democratic Party back to pay attention to the issues most important to the Democrats' core constituency. There are many, and you both might agree on this, that the Democrats for the last 8 years have really taken for granted its core constituency. And I would ask you if you think the inside strategy of working within the Democratic Party versus a new party, a Green Party alternative, is a way to get some action, to get some results. And I would ask you that first, Kathy Hurwitt.
Well, let me just say, I don't think it's fair to say that the Democratic Party has taken its base for granted. If you look at the issues that we're fighting on right now in Congress, it's adding a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, which really helps 13 million senior citizens who don't have any prescription drug coverage, HMO reform, putting money into the public school system, trying to pass better protections for immigrants, hate crimes, equal pay for equal work. I don't think we're really taking the base for granted. We're working hard to make sure, as I say, that I think it's 23 members of the Black Caucus will be subcommittee chairs or full committee chairs. It's not taking it for granted. Are we pushing as hard as we can, and are we winning the victories we're fighting? The answer, unfortunately, is no. And I think that until we get more progressives in Congress, in that body, we're not going to win. But I think it's, I mean, I understand concerns and I share the concerns about some of the positions that have been taken. But a lot of the fights that are going on right now are fights that really matter to the core of the Democratic Party.
Dr. Marble?
You know, I think we finally found something we disagree about. In 1990, there were 1 million people in prison. In 2000, there are 2 million people in prison. About a third were unemployed at the time of their arrest. About half are black. That's occurred under Clinton's watch. The devastating 1996 Welfare Act occurred with Gore's prodding. The devastation of our central cities, the passage of the trade acts of globalization, all of that occurred during the Clinton and Gore administration. And one could make a very effective case that it was only Clinton and the conservative Democrats who could have pushed that through Congress, because had a Republican been in the White House, you probably would have had a much stronger oppositional force from the Democratic Party. I'm not saying that Bush is therefore preferable to Gore. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is the best way to defeat the Bushes of the world is to build a strong inside and outside movement in the electoral system. We have to push for changing the rules of the political game. And right now, if we in effect surrender to the logic of the Democratic Leadership Council, all the things that you're talking about the progressive movement, that's not going to happen. And in effect, you've surrendered before we've already fought, because they basically agree substantively on public policy. They disagree about a number of questions, but on the main argument in terms of the relationship between the government and the masses of working and poor people and racial minorities, they don't disagree about the essentials.
I'm not going to be a defender of the DLC, and I'm not going to defend some of the policies, but I will tell you, if we didn't have Bill Clinton in the White House, we would have privatized Social Security and Medicare, and that would say to this country that the two most popular and most successful social insurance programs would be no more. Now, in terms of our fighting very hard to have a universal health care system that's modeled on the social insurance model of Medicare, that would be a disaster. I also want to say that the majority of Democrats in the House and the Senate were fighting for trade policies that protected labor rights and human rights and the environment. All I'm saying is it's a broad brush to say that the Democrats all across the board have forgotten their base, and in many instances all of the Democrats are pushing for the interests of their base.
All they have left is to frighten people in order to stop Bush to embrace Gore. And I think that that's going to work for core constituents. But I think also that the vast majority, the majority, maybe not the vast, because I would like to see black folk, Latinos, and poor people turn out to vote. Mm-hmm. But I think that for millions of people, that kind of appeal is not going to work anymore, because the Democratic Party overall, the national level, simply hasn't delivered. There are thousands of progressives who run as Democrats that we have to get out here and work for and support. But the leadership of the Democratic Party at the national level is so profoundly at odds with what core constituents want that Gore and that kind of DLC leadership has created the conundrum in which they find themselves. I would argue that it's important to defeat the right. It's important to defeat Bush. That's what I would like to see. But I think that in the long run, the best way to defeat the right is to build an independent, progressive movement that pressures the Democratic Party to transform the system.
That was Dr. Manning Maribel, Professor of History and Political Science at Columbia University, and Kathy Hurwit, Chief of Staff for Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, Democrat of Illinois. Whatever the outcome of this year's presidential and congressional election, some observers are noting that due to Ralph Nader's Green Party presidential candidacy, the US left is now more fully engaged in electoral politics than it has been since the days of the Vietnam War. Whether it's heated debates about the shortcomings of Al Gore and the conservative New Democrats, or a visceral fear of the policies of George W. Bush, progressive activists are debating electoral strategy and their future role in US politics. Despite his exclusion from the nationally televised candidate debates, Nader was drawing about 5% of the vote, according to opinion polls at the close of the campaign. Because the margin of victory or defeat is so small in many critical states, the left has been imbued with newfound power to influence this year's presidential contest. Progressives, by and large, have taken this responsibility quite seriously, some going so far as to launch sophisticated internet sites where citizens in states solidly for Gore or Bush can trade votes with worried Nader supporters in the so-called battleground states. Between the Lines spoke with John Nichols, an editor at the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and a columnist with The Nation magazine, who assesses the Nader candidacy's influence on progressive politics in the years ahead.
Well, there's no question that Ralph Nader has become the most dramatic player in the campaign. And what a fascinating situation. Here's a guy who was denied an ability to speak to the American people, to participate in the debate, and yet now we're at this point where everyone agrees he may decide the election. I mean, just that simple irony that the people of this country, the great majority of electors, were not allowed to hear from the guy who has such a powerful role. It, I think, completely exposes the crime, if you will, of the Commission on Presidential Debates and how they handled this year. But because Nader plays such a pivotal role in this year's election, and because he really has become this dramatic player at the end, the man whose vote total might decide whether Al Gore is elected president or not, progressives are placed in, frankly, what I think is a very good place. Finally, we have to think about critical core questions. Is it more important to us to elect a centrist Democrat and his right-wing running mate, or is it more important to build a long-term progressive movement that challenges the failures of both the Republican and the Democratic parties? That fundamental question is one that we on the left have tended to, you know, kind of dance around for many years. We're all for third parties and progressive politics and new approaches, but we never really have to fish or cut bait, as they say out here in the Midwest. This election has made a lot of us do it, and the dialogue that has developed out of that has been wonderful. I mean, rich and nuanced. There have been real, genuine arguments from very good people on both sides. You know, we ought to step back for a second and recognize that we on the left are having a unique debate within this election campaign. We should recognize that it proves that we're alive. It proves that we're part of things. In fact, again, going back to where we started here, it proves that we are a genuine force in American politics, one that cannot be denied, if only because we hold in our hand the ability, essentially, to decide whether Al Gore becomes president or not.
And John Nichols, in terms of what happens after the election, if Gore should happen to lose the election and he can count the Nader votes and know that's the margin that caused him to lose, what happens to the Green Party? Does the Green Party drive the Democrats to the center, to the left, or do the Greens become the target of very angry Democrats?
The latter, I'm afraid. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge this. if the Greens are the margin of error, if you will, in American politics, there will be bitter recriminations. And the Democrats are not a nice bunch of folks, frankly. I mean, there's a lot of them that are as cutthroat as any, you know, right-wing Republican. And yes, there. I think that may actually be, of all arguments for voting for Al Gore, that might be the best one, because the retribution would be so intense. I believe, at least in the short term, the interim after the election. But I will offer this one notion: in the long term, no matter what the result, here's the bottom line: whether Al Gore or George W. Bush is elected president, the single biggest legislative fight of the year 2001 will be over fast-track extension of the North American Free Trade Agreement to South and Central America. I guarantee you, it doesn't matter who's elected, Gore or Bush. And the coalition that will oppose that will be a broad, it'll be the WTO coalition, a broad labor, environmental, human rights movement. And it's going to have both sides. And I know it's going to be difficult, but when all is said and done, these two forces, progressive Democrats and the Greens, are going to be back together. Whether they like each other or not, they are going to be forced into a popular front against this very bad piece of legislation. And so, no matter what the result on November 7th, I think people like Paul Wellstone, who have really tried to maintain a dialogue between the two camps, Wellstone continues to talk to Nader on a relatively regular basis. I think people like that will work very hard to kind of pull this coalition together, knowing that there's bitterness, that there will be bitterness on both sides no matter what, but also knowing that, frankly, if somebody votes for Gore to stop Bush for progressive reasons, or if they vote for Nader to build a new movement, they could very well exactly share their principles on issues like globalization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, I think there's a measure of hope. These two sides of this question can't exist without one another. It is simply impossible in the American body politic for these two sides to remain at war. If they do, then they simply are ceding, you know, fundamental issues to the right, which I would argue is exists both within the Democratic and Republican parties.
That was John Nichols, an editor at the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. He writes the Beat column for The Nation magazine, which can be seen on the web at www.thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203 331 9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, at 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Tarr. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Rich Fraser, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Rees, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.